Water is essential to life, but also agriculture, industry, and energy. It is the foundation of modern civilization, but ever-rising consumption and climate change have many worried there won't be enough to go around. Meanwhile, sea level rise and extreme weather threaten some areas with disaster. How can we avoid conflict and build peace? How can we ensure everyone has what they need to survive and thrive as we march toward a global population of more than 9 billion? You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Water Stories, produced with support from USAID, we interview experts and practitioners from around the world to hear how people are thinking about and addressing water, peace, and conflict challenges. I'm Sean Peoples, and in this interview, we'll hear from Gidon Bromberg, Israeli co-director of EcoPeace Middle East. What is the Jordan River importance to the region in your work?
From the water perspective, it's the only river that we have in the Levant. This is the Mississippi of the Levant. The Jordan River starts around the Golan Heights and Hermon Mountain, and it's in fact three streams that flow into and become the River Jordan north of the Sea of Galilee, flows into this miraculous lake. It's the biggest lake in the Levant, called the Sea of Galilee. Again, full of story and legend and history, and then naturally would flow out of the Sea of Galilee down to the lowest place on Earth, the Dead Sea, which is actually the terminal lake of the River Jordan. The River Jordan has been the lifeblood of the Levant. It's been the focus of major development on the agricultural side, on hydropower. So few people actually know that in the 1920s, a hydroelectric power station was built on the River Jordan at the confluence with the Yarmouk River coming from the east. And the river produced 40% of the electricity of what was then Mandate Palestine. From an ecological perspective, it is really the whole valley, not just the river, but the great rift which the river is part of. This greatest fault line, longest fault line on Earth, 8,000 kilometers from Turkey all the way to Mozambique. So the river is really, really important for biodiversity, for the third largest bird migration on the planet. 500 million birds fly above the River Jordan, and they need the wetlands and the habitat that river provides to make the journey across the Sahara or back from the Sahara, depending on the migration period.
So your work seems to revolve around some of the things that you're talking about, biodiversity, Jordan River itself. Can you tell me where do you work and tell me what you do there?
So I work for EcoPeace Middle East. We're a really unique organization. We're Israeli, Palestinian, and Jordanian together. It's unique because there is no other organization, unfortunately, and I say that with sadness, that there is no other organization in any other issue that is trilateral like us. And I think that we exist because we have come from the environment, because as environmentalists, our philosophy is that borders don't count, that the environment will never respect these man-made political borders, and that therefore cooperation is not a gift, it's a necessity if we're to manage our resources sustainably. So as an organization, we've really focused on transboundary environmental issues and predominantly water, with the Jordan River being a flagship, a focus indeed of our work, to both repair the damage, and there's real damage that's been done It's not irreversible, and that's the good thing about nature. Rarely in nature are things completely irreversible. But nevertheless, the damage is great, and the loss is way beyond nature. The loss is to people's livelihoods on all three sides, and we very much connect to the social, economic, and environmental issues that we grapple with.
How do you go about creating a cooperative institution like EcoPeace in an area, in a region, where you've got Jordan, Israel, Palestine, where you've got the Jordan River that is, as you say, you know, the biodiversity there of that river is very important to that region. It's also threatened.
So the organization was established in 1994 following a political process. So there was the peace treaty signed between Israel and Jordan. The Oslo Accords were signed between Israelis and Palestinians. That created a platform that enabled a regional organization to be created. There was a sense of euphoria. We all thought that peace was about to break out completely. And in fact, the raison d'etre of creating the organization was the fear that environment wasn't on the peace agenda, that peace was going to lead to unsustainable development that was only going to further threaten the environment. Studies that in the very early days that we undertook showed that there were 50,000 new hotel rooms being proposed to be built around the Dead Sea without any consideration for carrying capacity. And therefore, the raison d'etre of the organization in the very beginning was to protect the environment, was to put the environmental issues onto the political agenda. Sadly, of course, the peace process never moved forward and in fact, very, very quickly declined, and more rounds of violence broke out. But by that time, the relationships established between the individuals. So if I think in the beginning, perhaps a common ideology, a common concern, but then it was the relationships developed that sustained the organization and enabled us to continue to stand up to the broader conflict, which was certainly impacting us and in some respects threatening us with individuals, with institutions telling us that we need to close down. But that those personal relationships that we had developed were became our strength. And then we also, because as individuals, we were very committed to peacemaking, to peace building, to cooperation. And we came to see that the relationships, the model that we had created in how we worked together was actually a model for peace. And that the role that that we should now play should be as much peace building as environment. And really we changed the way that we operated. So if in the early days we focused as a typical environmental organization, writing briefs, very top-down, very expert, speaking directly to decision makers and working through the media, when we started to understand the unique model that we were, we developed what has become the Good Water Neighbors program, which is very community-based. We hired local staff in local communities who came with a little bit of trust because they went to the school in the community, their family had relationships with the mayor's office perhaps, with business in that community. And we used, again, relationships as the basis to open the door, open those cracks in favor of cooperation. And the Good Water Neighbors program today has really become perhaps the model. Thomas Friedman from the New York Times twice came down with us to look at our programming. And in the end, he describes when talking about the Good Water Neighbors program as perhaps one of the most difficult things to build. But once built, the hardest thing to knock down, because again, it's those relationships on the ground, helping individuals identify self-interest but mutual gain, to on the ground ask questions that perhaps weren't asked before. Where is my water coming from? What's happening to my sewerage? Where does my waste go? What is the water reality of my neighbor? And literally taking people from youth to adults to municipal staff to the border, to the zone that was considered the danger zone, the backyard dumping ground. And of course, that's what happened to the River Jordan itself, because the river is the border between Israel, Jordan, and the West Bank. And in the mindset of conflict, not only did the countries, and in this case, it's Israel taking half of what used to flow down the river, and Syria and Jordan taking the other half, they took not only for legitimate needs of agriculture, urban development, industry, but in a desert area, water is power, and they took everything that they could. So the Sea of Galilee was dammed, and nothing would flow out of the Sea of Galilee other than in a once a decade and a flood year, and nothing would flow from the Yarmouk and the different tributaries to the east into the Jordan. And instead of fresh water flowing, sewage, everyone's sewage, was directed to the Jordan. And of course, fences and minefields and checkpoints. So very much out of sight, out of mind. And what we very effectively did at the community level was to bring people to see the demise, because for the most part, they had no idea. This was the place where the enemy was on the other side, so it was a bit of a danger zone even. Don't look, don't seek it out. And we brought literally tens of thousands of residents, often for the very first time, to look at the river and to look at the loss from a very different perspective. And once communities came to understand that this was a loss, that this was a lost opportunity, that in fact the residents of the Jordan Valley on all three sides, Israel, Palestine and Jordan, are the poorest in our respective countries, that they came to understand that perhaps there's a link between the ecological demise, the backyard dumping that the Jordan River had become, and their own economic prosperity. And once they understood that, and that it's not only site visits here, it was important to do research and to produce studies and briefs with economists and ecologists. So there's a very important synergy there that is critical to changing policies. But seeing is believing. Reports that speak of the economic loss then further affirm that actually we're all losers here. And then that is the change maker for peace building. Because as soon as the communities came to see that they're all losers, and that the only way to turn this around, the only way to truly promote economic development in my community was to work with the other side, to develop relations and try to move forward on a common agenda, then leaders, and in this case at the municipal level, mayors, were willing to do remarkable things that national government leaders wouldn't dare. So, the site that the picture that I always love to talk about is the big jump of the mayors, where Israeli, Palestinian, Jordanian mayors on a regular basis have jumped into a clean stretch, accessible to all sides, into the River Jordan. And it's not a pretty sight. It's predominantly men, and they have big bellies, and they make a big splash. But the significance is tremendous, because they jump into the river despite the fact they're not friends. There's animosity, there's conflict, there's occupation. They jump into the river together because they've come to a realization that they refuse to be losers, and the only way to become winners is literally to get wet together, to make a political statement. Jumping into the Jordan was actually a political statement made by a level of government, a low level, but a level that perhaps is more accountable, more transparent, and therefore a good actor to work with in the midst of conflict, if peace building is one of your objectives.
One of the audiences we have is someone who is actually maybe just starting out on a project, maybe not at the scale you as the Good Neighbors project, maybe at a smaller scale at the community level, but relationships, as you say, are really important at any level of these projects. And I think it's really great to hear you talk about that, because I think it's also personalities who really stick to it. What were some of the, for you, some of the challenges, and your colleagues, and among the network of people, the community that you were building with this project?
To all of us, to me personally, I never was truly prepared to be condemned, to be told that I'm a traitor. I mean, life doesn't naturally prepare yourself to hear that, to be told that what you're doing is somehow empowering the enemy. And that's an enormous accusation to stand up to. It goes to, you know, the very basis of your purpose. To be a traitor is to act against what some would say your national or your communal interest. And I think what we've learned is that in everything we do, in every act, public or not, we must prepare people to defend themselves, because they're going to be attacked, and it can be vicious, it can be violent, it can be life-threatening. So we've had staff shot at. We've had people taken away for interrogation because of working on our shared water resources. Remarkable. That's how threatening our cooperation has appeared to parties on all sides. So a key lesson is to prepare for that in a way that empowers people to defend themselves, to stand up for what they believe in, but in a manner that speaks to communal self-interest. Because we need to be thinking more broadly. Leadership is about moving people forward. Leadership is not listening to the loudest voices, even if they're the majority. Leadership is about moving what you truly believe in. And if others follow, then perhaps that's the right way to move. But if we don't speak to self-interest, then the broader community are not going to move in that direction. But it's not any type of self-interest that we need to identify. We need to empower people to speak to self-interest that leads to mutual gain, that creates opportunities for win-wins. Now, they don't have to be equal win-wins. They don't need to be the same win-wins. But if we can't, as an organization, identify how both sides will benefit from difficult moves, because these are difficult moves. You know, water in the middle of the desert is a critical resource that's scarce. And if you want people to compromise, if you want people to give up something, if you want people to behave differently in any field, then unless you can convince them that it's to their benefit, either immediate or longer term, then you're not going to succeed. In the midst of conflict, however, you have the double difficult task, is that you need to convince both sides at the same time that that both are going to benefit. Now, you don't need to explain to one side how the other side is. That's not important. But you do have to have that understanding worked out so that the framing, so that the messaging is well thought out in advance, that enables each side to defend themselves, to speak out, to speak of the self-interest as to why that the actions that we are doing, such as the mayor's jumping into the river. Well, we're jumping into the river together because we understand that we cannot improve the economic welfare of our valley unless we do that together. And often we found that working with youth has been a key entry point, because young people tend to have less prejudices, open minds. They tend to love the environment, which I think just speaks to human nature that we love to get dirty and muddy, and you know, that's part of our human experience. We found that youth were often braver than any other level of community interaction, from their perspective. If we need to work with the other side in order to solve a problem, then why aren't we doing that? And with youth from a community coming to the mayor and expressing concern about a water supply issue or a pollution issue, and saying, well, but in order to solve this, we need to work with the other side. So why aren't you doing that? Why aren't you looking after our own self-interest? That's very powerful. I come back to the importance of locality, of local people. Doing this effort really requires a level of trust that only a local person can build. So, you know, we're working in communities all over the region. Our offices are in Bethlehem, Amman, and Tel Aviv. Having someone from Bethlehem, Amman, or Tel Aviv to speak to someone in another community is not effective. They don't come with the level of trust that someone that has grown up in that community, that has more deeper societal relationships. And they're the key people to find. So in our work, we're coming as environmentalists, but these people don't need to be environmentalists by training. The most important quality is their commitment to improve their community, that they are committed to seeing a more prosperous community. And once they understand, and this is something that you can work with respective individuals, that cooperation is needed, that environment is key, that water, water resource issues are key issues. All the rest they can learn. But first and foremost, you need someone that cares, that is willing to be a little leader. In fact, they're the biggest leaders, because they actually are the very seeds that lead to the change in the community that allows. It's sad to me that it's often only when all the schools in the community were involved in the Good Water Neighbors program that the mayor would have, you know, would take the what he or she would have seen, take the brave step and meet with the mayor on the other side. That there was a significant amount of individuals. There was a constituency that were going to defend him. He needed to know, or she needed to know, mostly he, unfortunately, that there was someone backing him up, that was going to defend him in the meeting with the mayor on the other side, because there was he definitely knew that the next day he was going to be attacked, condemned in the press, risks re-election or reappointment, depending on the governance system. And these are really, you know, critical issues that individuals that are going to take on peace building of any kind, but certainly in a conflict setting, how to build those stepping stones.
Are there institutions from that hyper-local level where you've got the community talking, you know, staff who's from that community talking to community, people who are there because they do care, to institutions at a more regional level that you have leveraged or have used in a way that you think there are lessons from that? Practitioners are going to hit a wall sometimes when they have to actually convince a more formal body.
So I think some of the lessons in relate to having the community leadership speak to the national level institutions. Much more effective that mayors become your advocates, that mayors go to the ministers rather than environmentalists or activists who remain, you know, sort of highly suspicious. The mayors come with a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of national government. They're part of the system. They're government employees, and I think that's critical. The higher you go, the more important the science, the studies, economic studies, the research, showing the rationale, the economic benefit. We've spent lots of money working with economists to highlight the economic loss on the one hand and the economic gain if we were to behave differently. In fact, we invested €1 million to prepare the first ever integrated master plan for the Jordan Valley. We hired an international consultant to work with us for over 3 years to prepare the most extensive document that today exists. That really shows how a valley of poverty, it's currently the Jordan Valley, has a GDP of about $4 billion. Moving forward on the master plan, we show that we can transform the valley to a $73 billion economy. That has more implications than just money. When you have a $4 billion economy, you have, for about 600,000 people, you have real poverty. So on the Jordanian and Palestinian sides in particular, you have pockets of 40% unemployment. That's 50% youth unemployment. Intelligence services tell us that there's some 5,000 young people from the Jordan Valley fighting for ISIS. People that have lost hope, any sense of a future, are very vulnerable to extremist ideologies. So the results of the work go way beyond environment and economy. They really enter the field of human security and national security. And that brings the attention of the prime minister, presidents, and in the end, we need them as well. I mean, I think that's the other issue, is that we really need to hit all levels, and we can't miss out on any level in order to be effective. We need community support at its most basic. We need the mayors and local government. We need a national government institutions, from the bureaucracy to the ministers. But we also need the prime ministers and presidents and involvement of the international community. In the end, I mean, it really does take great effort a lot of different skill sets. So we're 100 staff, and you know, that's been built over time in order to deal with all those levels of intervention. But when you get that synergy right, it's remarkable what a change you can bring forth. And today we witness that change. We see tens of millions of dollars invested in cleaning up the River Jordan. So the sewage is coming out. New sewage treatment plants being built for the first time in the Jordan Valley. Fresh water being released for the first time in 49 years from the Sea of Galilee back to the River Jordan. Actual rehabilitation of riverbanks taking place. Economic investments moving forward. Now, I don't want to paint a rosy picture. There's a lot of work still to do, but we have 100 years of conflict, and in just 10 focused years of peace building, of advocacy, we've been able to, you know, through this multi-level intervention, change mindsets, and ministers and authorities that just several years ago were continuing to tell us that we're dreamers, that we're naive, that we're wasting our time. Today, some of them are the biggest advocates that this is their vision, that they're advocates for. And that really speaks to the success of the work, because it can't be our success. It must be their success. It must be all of our success together if we're truly to have the impact that we need to have.
A multi-level project, a multi-sector project in a lot of ways. For someone just starting out, what's your advice to them?
So I certainly come with a very open mind and throw away assumptions as best you can. Sometimes you don't even you don't know the assumptions that you bring forth. But I come in with a very open mind to listen to people on the ground. In conflict, you must listen to both sides with the same mindset, with the same open mindset, if you're to be effective. The fact, however, that you listen to everyone, it doesn't mean that you simply follow what they say. That's a different story. You need to understand where everyone is coming from, and then according to your own values and principles, try to get a roadmap up there. Try to think of, you know, what is the end game? Where do I want to get to? And then try to build back. Okay, where are the opportunities that I have? And this is very entrepreneurial. This is very opportunistic. No one is waiting with a silver plate that's going to tell you how to get there. There's lots of trial and error, and certainly be prepared to fail. Hopefully, you know, not fully on your face, but to not fully succeed. In every endeavor that we undertake, we expect that some of it will just not succeed. But how else can we learn? But as we're working and implementing, to be constantly, again, listening, seeing if we're effective, hearing other ideas. So the Good Water Neighbors program, which is 16 years old, has really evolved because our own staff in the different communities have been given a tremendous amount of leverage to experiment. And when something starts to work nicely in one community, then we adapt it and apply it to all. So, for instance, the Neighbours Path Trail was an idea of a local staff person that let's develop a trail that allows people to walk and see where their water is coming from and what's happening to their sewerage, and stop at a place of natural beauty or cultural importance. So there's pride of place, and then always look across the political divide and speak about the situation on the other side. So the Neighbours Path Trail was developed by one staff person as an idea. It took off. It was well received by the community, and then we carried it through to all of the communities of the Gurrawa Neighbours. The struggle that you often find is that funders don't come with the flexibility often needed. They ask you to specify in great detail exactly what you're going to do over the next 3 years, and that can often prevent you from grabbing those opportunities that develop during a funding program.
Are there things that you've witnessed over the years that you feel you could impart to someone who's maybe writing a request for proposals to fund water? Maybe people who are listening want to fund a water project, but they also need a place to start as well. I mean, you seem to have interfaced with a lot of funders. What can you tell them would be helpful for a project like yours, or even one just starting out?
So I think it's an issue of, what are you going to measure? Are you measuring how many people attended a conference, or how many people came together for some sort of cross-border activity? Or are you interested in change of mindset, changes of policies, the outputs and outcomes and sort of not the activities? And that's what funders should allow organizations to advance. And that requires a little bit more faith. That requires more flexibility, and perfectly understand that, you know, you need to come with a plan, but a funder needs to be able to have the width and depth to allow you to come back and say, 6 months later, these changes need to take place. And it's not because I didn't fully think things through necessarily. Perhaps. And perhaps, you know, we learn things on the way, but often there are changes that take place. Often there are new opportunities. So allow us to grab those opportunities. In conflict areas, there's generally few opportunities. You know, conflict is something that's very entrenched. Animosities are deep, particularly in a conflict setting. Funders need to show greater flexibility if what they're interested in is really the outcomes and not just the activities being performed themselves.
We're here in Washington, D.C., and for many people, what is it that Americans can do, or the American government can do, to help your efforts? What are the things that are important in this context here that would be supportive and not working at cross purposes?
So there's a great deal. I mean, firstly, there's tremendous interest and involvement in everything to do with Israel-Palestine in particular, coming from the United States, be it from faith groups, be it from the respective diasporas that are from the region that live here, that are very, very opinionated. I think, firstly, not just Americans, but from all outsiders, there's a need for more humility, that the answers are perhaps more complicated, that the issues are far more grey and not as black and white as perhaps some of the groups portray the situation, that both sides have a lot of responsibilities here. I think that the greatest role that outsiders, American or otherwise, can play is not to play the blame game, but to try and make the parties accountable. And that's an enormous difference. Playing the blame game empowers the victimhood that both sides feel. Both sides feel that the other is evil and we're just a victim of their behavior. And playing that blame game just reinforces those opinions and the victimhood mentality. But you're speaking honestly with both sides that you're accountable for your own future. No one is going to solve your issues for you. The two of you, the three of you, you need to solve these issues. We're happy to be on the sidelines to help in various ways, to guarantee various actions. But the hard negotiations need to be done by the parties themselves. I think that's a lesson that perhaps we've learned over these last 22 years, that perhaps the level of intervention and involvement of the international community as a whole in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict hasn't been helpful. That it's actually hardened. It's actually prevented compromises from moving forward, because 22 years later, since the signing of the Oslo Accords and since the signing of the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan, we see less support for peace. In fact, one of my greatest critiques and concerns has been that for 22 years, our own governments, but also the international community, have taken on an all-or-nothing approach. Either we can agree on all final status issues of the peace process, or we don't agree on anything. And that paradigm has led to no advance on anything for 22 years. So I think we can hardly blame the publics on both sides from not having any faith in a better future, in that there'll ever be peace, when for 22 years they've seen no progress. They've only seen more violence from all sides. And therefore, I think that the lesson for today is to move forward on what we can move forward, as long as it's in the same, it's in the direction. I mean, I think we have to stay principled and have a clear, in my perspective, a two-state solution is what we need. But if there are steps that we can move forward today, and what happens to be the low-hanging fruit of the peace process, perhaps the most solvable of the five final status issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict today is water. Yet we see a lot of reluctance to move forward on water separate. Everything is conditioned with everything else, and therefore nothing moves. That is not the way to build trust. That is not the way to build faith in a better future. That's an important lesson that we need to not only learn but implement today. We have an opportunity today to come to a final agreement, perhaps, between Israel and Palestine on water, if we can allow water to move forward first. And if we come to a final agreement on water today, people's livelihoods on all sides, on both sides, improved dramatically. More water in every Palestinian home. Sanitation issues that currently negatively impact both sides and really threaten a potential outbreak of pandemic disease. These issues would be avoided and improved welfare on the ground, and even no less importantly, a clear showing that there is a partner. Because if we can agree on one thing, then why can't we agree on other things? People are naturally skeptical, but when we show that we can reach an agreement on one issue, then we provide evidence that we have a partner to work with on the other issues too.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit our website, newsecuritybeat.org.